as I watch the news day by day and hear of yet more sickness and an ever-growing list of the dead. It seems that we're in a dark time. Nick reflected that in his prayers. Perhaps you are alone and fearful, or know those that who are. And I just hope for this few minutes, as we hear again the story of Jesus' resurrection, or this particular bit of the story, that it'll bring a little bit of light into the darkness. So I pray that the love and presence of the Lord Jesus would drive out our fears. Funnily enough, a fortnight ago, I was asked to preach on this story of the travellers on the road to Emmaus in our church in the Cotswolds, Burford. And that Sunday, the Sunday after Easter, is often called Low Sunday. It was assumed that people were so exhausted, I think, from going to church all through Holy Week, that they would take a Sunday off. Furthermore, vicars often take that Sunday off, and it's left to old retired hacks like me to fill in the void. It reminded me of the old joke about the bishop who turned up to preach at one of his churches, only to find hardly anyone there. So he asked the vicar, he said, "Didn't you tell them I was coming?" "No," replied the vicar, "but I have a horrible feeling it must have leaked out." I grew up in a Dorset vicarage with a fanatical fisherman for a father. And this time of year was quite special because he often had some time off after Easter and we would go fishing. It often coincided with the hatch of the Granham on the River Froon where we fished. So it could be a real bonanza, happy memories. Sadly, round here in the Cotswold, the decline and pollution of our local river, the Windrush, means the annual hatch of this wonderful little fly, the Granham, has been greatly reduced. Not that it would make much difference this year, as all fishing, like skiing and so much else, is on hold. So what can we do? Well, of course, one thing that many of us can do is go for a walk. We had a couple of days in Verbier after the lockdown, when the skiing had stopped, before we came home. And we went for some walks around the village, discovering bits of the village that we didn't even know existed before. We even got quite close up to St. Christoph's Chapel. Here in the Cotswolds, going for a daily walk has been a way of saying hi to people, always, of course, at a safe distance. Well, as you've heard in the reading, in Luke 24, we're told this wonderful story of a couple going on their daily exercise walk and having a life-changing encounter. It's the story of Cleopas and his friend, perhaps his wife, walking the 7-mile route from Jerusalem to the village of Emmaus. Perhaps a bit like walking to Le Chable and back, that sort of distance. Mercifully, probably for them, a bit flatter than that would be. Now, I discovered that Cleopas is really a shortened version of Cleopatros. So I think we should give ourselves some COVID-19 license and imagine Cleopatros and his beautiful wife Cleopatra going for their daily exercise walk. Like us on our walks these days, they were troubled by what was going on in the world. But they were clearly followers of Jesus. Cleopas is not, of course, one of the 12. They're just ordinary folk who encountered the risen Jesus. Just like you and me, perhaps. But I'm getting ahead of myself. On the road, they're joined by a figure that they don't recognize. Now, most of us on this Zoom service are skiers, so we should be able to relate to this pretty well. How often have we encountered people on the slopes, helmeted and goggled, and not recognized them at all? If you're like me, the best hope is identifying them by the color of their ski jacket or their salopettes, but that's far from foolproof. Now you go into the restaurant, they take off their helmet and their goggles, you look around and suddenly there are people there that you recognize as they break bread, you might say. Now, I don't suppose Jesus had a helmet on, but perhaps he was wearing a hoodie like our teenagers. If only they knew they were following Jesus when they put a hoodie on. Or is it possible that they had never seen Jesus close to? Perhaps Cleopas and his friend or his wife, whoever it is, perhaps they'd always been at the back of the crowd, some distance from Jesus. In Swinbrook, the village in the Burford Benefice where I help out, we have some lovely special people who have not been churchgoers really before, and they much prefer to sit at the back of the church. I tease them by calling it the royal box. Perhaps Cleopatros and Cleopatra were like that. Anyway, they didn't recognize him at first. I mean, since he had been crucified and buried on Friday, they would hardly be expecting to encounter him, would they? Meeting people unexpectedly can produce some strange reactions. I remember some years ago at a golf day that I was playing in, bumping into the actor Robert Powell, who had just been acting Jesus in that rather wonderful TV series some years ago, Jesus of Nazareth. I was so surprised to see him that I recall blurting out, "Have you met Jesus yet, or are you still acting him?" It wasn't a great start to the conversation, to be honest. Cleopas assumes the stranger has been self-isolating. Interesting how new words have entered our lives, as he seems to be ignorant of the events that have occurred over the weekend in Jerusalem. In verses 19 to 24, Cleopas sums up the feeling of those whose hopes and dreams have been crushed. The one they hoped would rescue Israel from Roman occupation had been executed, and now some ludicrous rumor of him being risen from the dead was circulating. But they say, as many say today, him they did not see. You see, something else needed to happen for the encounter with the risen Jesus to become real. So the conversation takes what, to me at least, is an unexpected turn. You would expect Jesus simply to reveal himself to them at this point. He could have said, "Look, here I am." Those women who reported that I had risen, they were right. But he doesn't do that, but rather does for the first time what the church on its good days has been trying to do ever since. Actually, what we're trying to do through the English-speaking church in Verbier, Sunday by Sunday. He sets his death and resurrection in the context of what theologians call salvation history. He explains as they walk along how Moses' rescue of the people from Egypt points to another great rescue, the cross of Calvary. And then that the scriptures, particularly the prophets of the Old Testament, always anticipated a suffering servant Messiah, not a victorious warrior. Now the latter, the warrior, might win a battle or two, but only the atoning death of the Messiah in humanity's place, in your place and mine, only the death of Jesus would win the war against sin and death. And Jesus from the Bible shows how his ministry fulfilled the Old Testament. Perhaps Cleopas and his wife, or whoever it was, who perhaps they were there and recalled how they had seen Jesus opening the eyes of the blind or helping the deaf to hear during his earthly ministry. Things, of course, that the Old Testament said the Messiah would do. Sometimes those miracles took a little while to be effective. Gradually, sight came back. Do you remember how one of them said that he saw people like trees, first of all? See, faith, like sight and hearing being restored, sometimes comes gradually. Perhaps that is where you are this evening. Can it really be true? Can Jesus really be alive? For Cleopatras and Cleopatra, the penny slowly began to drop. Then as they entered their house in Emmaus and began to eat, Jesus removed his hoodie perhaps, and as they broke bread together, as the disciples had in the upper room, they recognized him. They were of course thrilled and rushed back to Jerusalem to be with the other believers. But it's significant that Luke tells us that their hearts were burning within them as Jesus opened the scriptures to them. What they discovered is what every Christian ever since has discovered, that when the whole Bible is understood, when salvation history is explained, the world and our place in it begin to make sense. It's not just, you see, that they discover Jesus' identity, that he's the Son of God because he's risen from the dead, which is sensational enough. But they, like we, when we become followers of Jesus, discover their own identity as we discover our own identity. The resurrection of Jesus is the greatest event in the history of the world. He is our trailblazer into eternity, physically recognizable, but not confined by time and space. The rest of the chapter, like the other gospel accounts of the resurrection, informs us how the risen Jesus, over a period of a few weeks, made himself known to his followers. He was commissioning them for the great work of winning the world. They were utterly changed by the experience, from frightened refugees, really, fleeing the authorities, they became bold evangelists. Within a few years, the number of believers grew from a handful to thousands. No doubt our Cleopatros and Cleopatra played their part. Now here we are, in Verbier and scattered around the world, just 2,000 years on. Peter in his second letter said that's just 2 days in God's time. One day is like 1,000 years, he writes. And now there are something like 2.5 billion Christians in the world. 2.5 billion Christians. That's the estimate. I expect that most of us listening to this talk, most of us taking part in this service, are in that vast number of believers. But maybe you're not quite sure yet. So let me encourage you right now, perhaps all of us could do this, to say in our hearts what the disciples said in Luke 24, verse 34. To say it in our heart. Well, why not say it out loud if you want to? It is true, the Lord is risen. It is true, the Lord is risen. It is true, the Lord is risen. Have you done that? Do you begin to believe it? Do you notice how your heart burned within you too? We're going to listen now to a hymn sung by the three tenors. I just want to tell you a little bit about it. It's a very well-known hymn, It Is Well With My Soul. But I want to give you a bit of background. Excuse my cough, I haven't got COVID. Horatio Spafford, who wrote the hymn, was from Chicago. And he had a Norwegian wife, Anna, and 4 children. Wife and children were on their way to England in 1873 when the ship that they sank in the Atlantic and all 4 children were drowned. Anna survived, and in due course, Horatio followed, and he wrote this great hymn in the spot in the Atlantic where the boat went down. Here is a copy of the original words of the hymn written by Horatio Spafford. And the reason that I have this copy is that a friend of ours is a chap called Frank Spencer Nairn, who lives in Scotland, and he is Horatio Spafford's great-grandson. See, what happened was that he and Anna had 3 more children, Bertha Grace, and a boy who died in infancy. And Bertha is Frank's grandmother. And Frank says, if that ship had not sunk, I would almost certainly never have existed. You see, terrible things happen. They are terrible. There is real pain and suffering in the world. But out of terrible events, out of darkness, God can bring amazing light. So we may be deeply perplexed by what is happening in the world, as of course those 2 strangers were on the road. But God has not lost control. It is well with my soul, Horatio Spafford wrote. We're going to listen to the three tenors and then we're going to sing the hymn afterwards. Incidentally, the lady that you'll see in the audience is also a great granddaughter of Horatio Spafford, Frank's cousin, Jamelia. And you'll see her. This concert was recorded in Bath. There's a story behind that, but I won't go into that now. Let's listen to this wonderful hymn.